The Novels of Charles Dickens. An Introduction by David Timson. Martin Chuzzlewit. By the 1840s, Dickens was beginning to feel the strain of maintaining his exhausting output. After he had completed Barnaby Rudge in 1841, Dickens at last drew the line and told his publishers, Chapman and Hall, that he would be taking a year off. He resolved to spend part of that time in America. The new world of America proved a catalyst to Dickens's fertile imagination. At first impressed with its energy, Dickens soon came to despise the brash vulgarity that characterized this emerging nation in the 1840s. Dickens began to see America as a lost opportunity for the founding of a new society based on freedom and equality. Instead, it appeared to be developing into a land eager to exploit and make money out of the oppressed, just as in Europe. His experience was published in a collection of essays on the American way of life called American Notes. The tone is that of an innocent abroad, seeing, observing, only mildly judgmental. But his profound disillusion with America was soon to find another outlet in his next novel, Martin Chuzzlewit. Dickens began his new novel in November 1842. He was in a confident mood, but his creativity could never flow until he had got the right names for his characters. They were their names. So, amongst his working notes for this novel is a sheet of paper full of experiment. Martin, for his hero's Christian name, he had already decided on. But should he be Chuzzlewig, Chubblewig, Chuzzletoe, or Chuzzlebog? Or even Sweezledon, Sweezelbash, or Sweezelwag? For a while he settled on Martin Chuzzlewig, but then changed it to Chuzzlewit. The novel's theme is selfishness in its many manifestations. We meet the unprepossessing Chuzzlewit family in the first chapter, all looking out for their own self-interest, vying for an inheritance. Even the youngest members of the family are tainted with the vice, and when we meet young Martin, the eponymous hero, he is arrogant and self-centred. We follow him making his way in the world and slowly see his personality change for the better through experience. Dickens soon realized that this novel was not going to fit into any pattern he had formerly used. Martin Chuzzlewit turned out, in fact, to be three books in one, with the addition of a great comic turn. In the first book, we have a family history and Martin's struggle to escape their inherited characteristics. But it is in the second book that the novel begins to take wing. Drawing on his recent experiences, Dickens sends his young hero to America, using all his comic and satirical genius to expose its people's brutality, coarseness, and relentless pursuit of self-interest. The relatively mild criticism in American Notes became a savage attack in Chuzzlewit. America in the 1840s was still largely unknown to the British public, who were fascinated by Dickens's opinions. Not so the American critics, who were vituperative. The third book within a book comes from the darker side of Dickens's nature. He was always fascinated by the macabre, and in the character of Jonas Chuzzlewit, he takes us into the mind of a murderer, and we experience firsthand his dark and self-destructive fears. Dickens anticipates Dostoevsky's masterly study of a murderer in Crime and Punishment, and it may be that this study of Jonas influenced Dostoevsky, who was a passionate reader of Dickens's novels. These three books are linked by a vein of richly comic humour that runs throughout the novel. It contains perhaps Dickens's most creative comedy so far. Even the minor characters are memorable, such as Mrs. Todgers and her eternal struggle with the gravy. But the greatest creations are Pecksniff, a comic study of unctuous hypocrisy, and that wildly eccentric comic turn, Mrs. Gamp, a professional nurse, midwife, and layer out of the dead. Pecksniff cites the Bible for his own purposes to shield his devious plan of self-aggrandizement, hiding his true nature behind mock humility. "Bless you for hating me," he says to old Martin. Pecksniff's hypocrisy is transparent to the reader, and therein lies the humour. Sarah Gamp is Dickens's greatest comic creation. She appealed to Dickens's sense of theatre, and her rambling monologues, peppered with distorted and invented words, are in danger at times of upstaging the rest of the novel. But beneath Gamp's eccentricity lies a serious purpose on Dickens's part, to expose the incompetence, not to say danger, of unregulated private nurses. It was Florence Nightingale's reforms and innovations that eventually established a publicly funded profession. When Martin Chuzzlewit was published in novel form in 1844, a critic wrote that it was just now the rage to decry Dickens. But the more discerning critics, however, saw it as an advance in Dickens's literary style. The loose, episodic format of his earlier novels was developing into a more cohesive structure, with a strong moral purpose or theme expressed through sublime humour. Dickens himself said, "I feel my power now more than I ever did." Pecksniff and his daughters journey to London.
When Mr. Pecksniff and the two young ladies got into the heavy coach at the end of the lane, they found it empty, which was a great comfort, particularly as the outside was quite full and the passengers looked very frosty. For as Mr. Pecksniff justly observed, when he and his daughters had burrowed their feet deep in the straw, wrapped themselves to the chin and pulled up both windows, it is always satisfactory to feel, in keen weather, that many other people are not as warm as you are. And this, he said, was quite natural, and a very beautiful arrangement, not confined to coaches, but extending itself into many social ramifications. For, he observed, if everyone were warm and well-fed, we should lose the satisfaction of admiring the fortitude with which certain conditions of men bear cold and hunger. And if we were no better off than anybody else, what would become of our sense of gratitude? Which, said Mr. Pecksniff, with tears in his eyes as he shook his fist at a beggar who wanted to get up behind, is one of the holiest feelings of our common nature. His children heard with becoming reverence these moral precepts from the lips of their father, and signified their acquiescence in the same by smiles. That he might the better feed and cherish that sacred flame of gratitude in his breast, Mr. Pecksniff remarked that he would trouble his eldest daughter, even in this early stage of their journey, for the brandy bottle. And from the narrow neck of that stone vessel he imbibed a copious refreshment. "What are we?" said Mr. Pecksniff. "But coaches. Some of us are slow coaches." "Goodness, Pa!" cried Charity. "Some of us, I say," resumed her parent, with increased emphasis, "are slow coaches. Some of us are fast coaches. Our passions are the horses, and rampant animals, too." "Really, Pa!" cried both the daughters at once. "How very unpleasant!" "And rampant animals, too," repeated Mr. Pecksniff with so much determination that he may be said to have exhibited, at the moment, a sort of moral rampancy himself. "And virtue is the drag. We start from the mother's arms, and we run to the dust shovel." When he had said this, Mr. Pecksniff, being exhausted, took some further refreshment. When he had done that, he corked the bottle tight, with the air of a man who had effectually corked the subject also, and went to sleep for three stages.
Pecksniff and his daughters at Mrs. Todgers.
M. Todgers's commercial boarding house was a house of that sort which is likely to be dark at any time, but that morning it was especially dark. There was an odd smell in the passage, as if the concentrated essence of all the dinners that had been cooked in the kitchen since the house was built lingered at the top of the kitchen stairs to that hour, and, like the black friar in Don Juan, wouldn't be driven away. In particular, there was a sensation of cabbage, as if all the greens that had ever been boiled there were evergreens and flourished in immortal strength. The parlour was wainscoted, and communicated to strangers a magnetic and instinctive consciousness of rats and mice. The staircase was very gloomy and very broad, with balustrades so thick and heavy that they would have served for a bridge. In a sombre corner on the first landing stood a gruff old giant of a clock, with a preposterous coronet of three brass balls on his head, whom few had ever seen, none ever looked in the face, and who seemed to continue his heavy tick for no other reason than to warn heedless people from running into him accidentally. It had not been papered or painted, hadn't Todgers's, within the memory of man. It was very black, begrimed, and mouldy. And at the top of the staircase was an old, disjointed, rickety, ill-favoured skylight, patched and mended in all kinds of ways, which looked distrustfully down at everything that passed below, and covered Todgers's up as if it were a sort of human cucumber frame, and only people of a peculiar growth were reared there. Mr. Pecksniff and his fair daughters had not stood warming themselves at the fire 10 minutes when the sound of feet was heard upon the stairs, and the presiding deity of the establishment came hurrying in. M. Todgers was a lady, rather a bony and hard-featured lady, with a row of curls in front of her head, shaped like little barrels of beer, and on the top of it something made of net. You couldn't call it a cap, exactly, which looked like a black cobweb. She had a little basket on her arm, and in it a bunch of keys that jingled as she came. In her other hand she bore a flaming tallow candle, which, after surveying Mr. Pecksniff for one instant by its light, she put down upon the table to the end that she might receive him with the greater cordiality.
"Mr. Pecksniff," cried Mrs. Todgers, "welcome to London. Who would have thought of such a visit as this after so, oh dear, dear, so many years? How do you do, Mr. Pecksniff?"
"As well as ever, and as glad to see you as ever," Mr. Pecksniff made response. "Why, you are younger than you used to be."
"You are, I'm sure," said Mrs. Todgers. "You're not a bit changed."
"What do you say to this?"
cried Mr. Pecksniff, stretching out his hand towards the young ladies.
"Does this make me no older?"
"Not your daughters," exclaimed the lady, raising her hands and clasping them. "Oh, no, Mr. Pecksniff, your second and her bridesmaid."
Mr. Pecksniff smiled complacently, shook his head, and said,
"My daughters, Mrs. Todgers, merely my daughters."
"Ah," sighed the good lady, "I must believe you, for now I look at them, I think I should have known them anywhere. My dear Miss Pecksniffs, how happy your pa's made me."
She hugged them both, and being by this time overpowered by her feelings, or the inclemency of the morning, jerked a little pocket handkerchief out of the little basket and applied the same to her face.
"Now, my good madam," said Mr. Pecksniff, "I know the rules of your establishment, and that you only receive gentlemen boarders. But it occurred to me, when I left home, that perhaps you would give my daughters house room, and make an exception in their favour."
"Perhaps," cried Mrs. Todgers ecstatically, "perhaps."
"I may say, then, that I was sure you would," said Mr. Pecksniff. "I know that you have a little room of your own, and that they can be comfortable there without appearing at the general table."
"Dear girls," said Mrs. Todgers, "I must take that liberty once more."
Mrs. Todgers meant by this that she must embrace them once more, which she accordingly did with great ardour. But the truth was that the house being full, with the exception of one bed, which would now be occupied by Mr. Pecksniff, she wanted time for consideration. And so much time, too, for it was a knotty point how to dispose of them, that even when this second embrace was over, she stood for some moments gazing at the sisters, with affection beaming in one eye and calculation shining out of the other.
Mrs. Gamp.
Mrs. Gamp had a large bundle with her, a pair of pattens, and a species of gig umbrella, the latter article in colour like a faded leaf, except where a circular patch of a lively blue had been dexterously let in at the top. She was much flurried by the haste she had made, and laboured under the most erroneous views of cabriolets, which she appeared to confound with mail coaches or stage wagons, inasmuch as she was constantly endeavouring for the first half mile to force her luggage through the little front window, and clamouring to the driver to put it in the boot. When she was disabused of this idea, her whole being resolved itself into an absorbing anxiety about her pattens, with which she played innumerable games at quoits on Mr. Pecksniff's legs. It was not until they were close upon the house of mourning that she had enough composure to observe,
"And so the gentleman's dead, sir. Ah, oh, the more's the pity."
She didn't even know his name.
But it's what we must all come to. It's as certain as being born, except that we can't make our calculations as exact. Oh, poor dear.
She was a fat old woman, this Mrs. Gamp, with a husky voice and a moist eye, which she had a remarkable power of turning up and only showing the white of it. Having very little neck, it cost her some trouble to look over herself, if one may say so, at those to whom she talked. She wore a very rusty black gown, rather the worse for snuff, and a shawl and bonnet to correspond. In these dilapidated articles of dress she had, on principle, arrayed herself, time out of mind, on such occasions as the present. For this at once expressed a decent amount of veneration for the deceased, and invited the next of kin to present her with a fresher suit of weeds, an appeal so frequently successful that the very fetch and ghost of Mrs. Gamp, bonnet and all, might be seen hanging up any hour in the day in at least a dozen of the second-hand clothes shops about Holborn. The face of Mrs. Gamp, the nose in particular, was somewhat red and swollen, and it was difficult to enjoy her society without becoming conscious of a smell of spirits. Like most persons who have attained to great eminence in their profession, she took to hers very kindly, insomuch that, setting aside her natural predilections as a woman, she went to a lying in or a laying out with equal zest and relish.
"Ah," repeated Mrs. Gamp,
for it was always a safe sentiment in cases of mourning.
"Oh, dear. When Gamp was summoned to his long home, and I see him a-lying in Guy's Hospital with a penny piece on each eye, and his wooden leg under his left arm, I thought I should have fainted away. But I bore up."
If certain whispers current in the Kingsgate Street circles had any truth in them, she had indeed borne up surprisingly, and had exerted such uncommon fortitude as to dispose of Mr. Gamp's remains for the benefit of science. But it should be added, in fairness, that this had happened 20 years before, and that Mr. and Mrs. Gamp had long been separated on the ground of incompatibility of temper in their drink.
"You have become indifferent since then, I suppose," said Mr. Pecksniff. "Use is second nature, Mrs. Gamp."
"You may well say second nature, sir," returned that lady. "One's first ways is to find sich things a trial to the feelings, and so is one's lasting custom. If it wasn't for the nerve a little sip of liquor gives me, I never was able to do more than taste it. I never could go through with what I sometimes has to do. 'Mrs. Harris,' I says, at the very last case as ever I acted in, which it was but a young person, 'Mrs. Harris,' I says, 'leave the bottle on the chimney-piece, and don't ask me to take none, but let me put my lips to it when I am so disposed, and then I will do what I am engaged to do according to the best of my ability.' 'Mrs. Gamp,' she says in answer, 'if ever there was a sober creetur to be got at 18 pence a day for working people and 3 and 6 for gentlefolks, night watching,' said Mrs. Gamp with emphasis, 'being a extra charge, you are that inwallable person. Mrs. Harris,' I says to her, 'don't name the charge, for if I could afford to lay all my fellow creatures out for nothing, I would gladly do it, sich is the love I bears them. But what I always says to them as has the management of matters, Mrs. Harris,'"
here she kept her eye on Mr. Pecksniff,
"'be they gents or be they ladies, is, don't ask me whether I won't take none or whether I will, but leave the bottle on the chimney-piece and let me put my lips to it when I am so disposed.'"
Martin arrives in Eden, America.
As they proceeded further on their track and came more and more towards their journey's end, the monotonous desolation of the scene increased to that degree that for any redeeming feature it presented to their eyes, they might have entered in the body on the grim domains of giant despair. A flat morass bestrewn with fallen timber, a marsh on which the good growth of the earth seemed to have been wrecked and cast away, that from its decomposing ashes vile and ugly things might rise, where the very trees took the aspect of huge weeds begotten of the slime from which they sprung by the hot sun that burnt them up. where fatal maladies, seeking whom they might infect, came forth at night in misty shapes, and creeping out upon the water, hunted them like spectres until day, where even the blessed sun, shining down on festering elements of corruption and disease, became a horror. This was the realm of hope through which they moved. At last they stopped. At Eden, too. The waters of the deluge might have left it but a week before. So choked with slime and matted growth was the hideous swamp which bore that name. There being no depth of water close inshore, they landed from the vessel's boat with all their goods beside them. There were a few log houses visible among the dark trees, the best a cowshed or a rude stable. But for the wharves, the marketplace, the public buildings...
"Here comes an Edener," said Mark. "He'll get us help to carry these things up. Keep a good heart, sir. Hello there!"
A man advanced toward them through the thickening gloom, very slowly, leaning on a stick. As he drew nearer, they observed that he was pale and worn, and that his anxious eyes were deeply sunken in his head. His dress of homespun blue hung about him in rags. His feet and head were bare. He sat down on a stump halfway, and beckoned them to come to him. When they complied, he put his hand upon his side as if in pain, and while he fetched his breath, stared at them, wondering.
"Strangers!" he exclaimed, as soon as he could speak.
"The very same," said Mark.
"How are you, sir?" "I've had the fever very bad," he answered faintly. "I haven't stood upright these many weeks. Those are your notions, I see," pointing to their property.
"Yes, sir," said Mark, "they are. You couldn't recommend us someone as would lend a hand to help carry him up to the town, could you, sir?"
"My eldest son would do it, if he could," replied the man. "But today he has his chill upon him, and is lying wrapped up in the blankets. My youngest died last week."
"Oh, I'm sorry for it, Governor, with all my heart," said Mark, shaking him by the hand. "Don't mind us. Come along with me, and I'll give you an arm back. The goods is safe enough, sir," to Martin. "There ain't many people about to make away with them. What a comfort that is."
"No," cried the man. "You must look for such folk here,"
knocking his stick upon the ground,
"or yonder in the bush, towards the north. We've buried most of them. The rest have gone away. Them that we have here don't come out at night."
"The night air ain't quite wholesome, I suppose," said Mark.
"It's deadly poison," was the settler's answer.
Mark showed no more uneasiness than if it had been commended to him as ambrosia. But he gave the man his arm, and as they went along explained to him the nature of their purchase, and inquired where it lay. Close to his own log house, he said, so close that he had used their dwelling as a storehouse for some corn. They must excuse it that night, but he would endeavour to get it taken out upon the morrow. He then gave them to understand, as an additional scrap of local chit-chat, that he had buried the last proprietor with his own hands, a piece of information which Mark also received without the least abatement of his equanimity. In a word, he conducted them to a miserable cabin rudely constructed of the trunks of trees, the door of which had either fallen down or been carried away long ago, and which was consequently open to the wild landscape and the dark night. Saving for the little store he had mentioned, it was perfectly bare of all furniture. But they had left a chest upon the landing place, and he gave them a rude torch in lieu of candle. This latter acquisition Mark planted in the earth, and then declaring that the mansion looked quite comfortable, hurried Martin off again to help bring up the chest. And all the way to the landing place and back, Mark talked incessantly, as if he would infuse into his partner's breast some faint belief that they had arrived under the most auspicious and cheerful of all imaginable circumstances. But many a man who would have stood within a home dismantled, strong in his passion and design of vengeance, has had the firmness of his nature conquered by the raising of an air-built castle. When the log hut received them for the second time, Martin laid down upon the ground and wept aloud.
These extracts have been taken from the unabridged recording of Martin Chuzzlewit, read by Sean Barrett for Naxos Audiobooks.